the next few nights, we're going to be looking at some more detail of the content of the teachings in early Buddhism. And as many people have remarked, that the number of suttas that we have, the sheer number of them, can sometimes be overwhelming. And that's true. So we need a starting point. And so it's a little bit arbitrary what we choose. We could have chosen a number of different frameworks, a way of looking at it, but we decided to look at it in terms of sila, samadhi, panya, which of course you're all familiar with, ethics, meditation, or samadhi, and wisdom. And over the next few days, we'll be looking at each of these in turn. And of course, this is just one of the many important teaching frameworks that we find in early Buddhism. I think it's a very useful and very practical one, and very interesting in many respects. So we'll go through this for the next few days, and I think because we have a 3-hour session these evenings, we're kind of adapting a course which was originally intended for a day-long workshop. So what I'm thinking is that we'll split each topic into more or less 2 days, and we will each day we'll have a talk and some Q&A, and then we'll have a break and then the discussion as we did on the weekend, and then coming back after the discussion. So I think we're finishing up at 10, is that right? Yeah, okay. Okay, so let's go on. So we're thinking, looking at the teachings that are found in the early suttas. One of the characteristics of the teaching is this, that if you think, we think back to the former time, to the time of the Buddha, and there's monks and nuns wandering around the place, staying in different monasteries and so on. And so the Sangha has to organize things so that all the teachings can be recited and preserved. And one of the things is that there would have been very few monks in any time who memorized everything, right? Now, what would monks have learned? Well, okay, for a start, pretty much everybody would have learned a basic vocabulary, okay, a basic curriculum. So, common suttas like the Dhammacakka Sutta or the things like the Mangala Ratna Sutta or things like that, which are very common, they would have been recited by everybody. So then once you get beyond that basic curriculum, then they would have started to specialize. And typically it seems that in the monasteries they would specialize in one or other Nikaya. Okay, so you might have like a teacher who was an expert in the Digha Nikaya or the Majjhima Nikaya and so on. But then when they did that, they didn't just teach all of that, but they might have had again a core set of suttas for that Nikaya. So when you start out, you learn that core set of suttas, and maybe if you're very talented, you might learn the whole thing or perhaps half of it and so on. So again, not everybody's learning everything. Everyone's learning parts of things. And one of the things that suggests or that helps to explain is we talked on the weekend about the idea of repetition, and I mentioned that one of the reasons for that repetition was for backup, right? So to preserve the information. But another reason for the repetition is to distribute the teachings among the different collections. Okay, so if I study the Digha Nikaya, well, I don't have everything that's included in the Majjhima Nikaya, right? But I should have the important things, right? And similarly, if I study the Anguttara Nikaya, I'm not going to have everything that I might be found in the Digha Nikaya, but I should have the important things, right? So what we usually find is that across the four Nikayas, all of those central teachings are found in each Nikaya. And so, for example, the Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, Four Noble Truths, and so on and so forth. And these things we find in each of the Nikayas, okay? So one of the things that suggests is that this can be a guide for us about what actually is the important teachings, yeah? And so, of course, this teaching on Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, meditation, and wisdom, this is one of those teachings that's found across all of the Nikayas, and in fact is found very prominently in each of the Nikayas, not just in the four main Nikayas, also in the Agamas, also in the Vinaya, also in the Abhidhamma. It's very, very widely distributed. everybody in that early Sangha would have known about these teachings. And it was regarded within the tradition as being highly important. We know that, for example, just one example, in the Theravadin tradition, the most famous later book that was developed is a book called the Visuddhi Magga, The Path of Purification. Probably got copies of it in the library, and it's well worth a read. But the Visuddhi Magga is organized on the framework of Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, meditation, wisdom, right? The whole big book of the Visuddhi Magga. In fact, it's a bit of a kind of literary conceit in the Visuddhi Magga. It begins with a verse, just one short verse that mentions Sila, Samadhi, Panya. And then it says, well, the meaning of this is a bit obscure, so we'll have to give an explanation. And then the whole rest of the Visuddhi Magga's big thick book is meant to be an explanation of this one verse and this teaching on Sila, Samadhi, Panya there. So the fact that it's distributed so widely is a good indication that it's a very important teaching. Okay, now I mentioned one of the other things that we talked about in the on the weekend was that we have an idea of doctrinal evolution, right? We have shifts in the meaning of things, the way things are treated, and I said that you can trace this doctrinal evolution in every single important teaching in Buddhism. Okay, now that's not to say, please don't misunderstand me, it's not to say that the later traditions got everything in every teaching wrong. Okay, it just means that, you know, each generation, as we go down, we explain and we understand things, we interpret it in a new way, we explain it from a new perspective, we look at different aspects of it. And sometimes those different aspects might be contradictory or different from what we find in the early texts, but a lot of the times it's just a different way of seeing it, right? It's not actually right or wrong, it's just a bit different. And so when we look at the Sila, Samadhi, Panya, and especially for the next couple of days we're looking at the Sila, which I'm translating here as ethics, that's no exception, and we find that there are significant differences between the way that ethics are treated in early Buddhism to the way that they're treated in later Buddhism. And usually where the later texts have changed things from the earlier texts, they're not as good anyway. That's just a value judgment, but that's what I reckon. So what are some examples of that? Okay, so an ethic of intention versus an ethic of rules, right? So in the early texts, we have a lot of emphasis on the idea of intention, and what is the reason that you're doing something, right? So we're looking at the inner motivation for doing certain acts, whereas in later times it tended to be much more kind of rule based. It's much more kind of based on the letter of things. Intention becomes less important. A good example of that is in the Sangha, where we recite our Patimokkha, and each fortnight we recite the Patimokkha rules. Now in the Vinaya itself and in the Patimokkha it says, and I'm quoting, it says, if a bhikkhu remembers having committed an offence, then he should confess it. Yeah? But these days, you just do a blanket confession for all offences, right? You don't have to remember everything, but they do it in different ways in different countries, but they basically say, you know, for all offences I've committed in the past, present and future that I may have committed or may not have committed, whether intentionally or unintentionally, knowingly or unknowingly, then I confess all of them, right? So that's very useful, right? You can just sort of wipe everything away without having to think about it. Right? Without having to face the consequences of it, right? And of course the whole purpose of confession is that you actually share that offence with another bhikkhu, right? And once you're all just going, I'm confessing all offences past, present and future, well, you're not actually meaningfully doing anything. You're just reciting a formula. And unfortunately this is what actually happens in most places in the Sangha these days. There are variations across the different traditions, but most of the time they do something like that. So in our monasteries we try to make it more meaningful and to actually confess the offences that we've actually done. But, you know, it's hard to get away from these things. In Bodhnyana, Ajahn Brahmali made a protest about this and said we shouldn't recite these blanket confessions at all. See, normally we do the blanket confession and then we say it in English and confess any offences if we have them, and Brahmali argued that we shouldn't have the blanket confession at all. It was completely against the spirit of the early Vinaya, and basically Ajahn Brahm said, well, it's alright for you but none of the other monks. So now Ajahn Brahmali is the only one who's allowed to not do the blanket confession. So
So when you've been around for as long as Ajahn Brahmali has, and you've studied the Vinaya and you're a very sincere monk like he is, and when you're stubborn and argumentative also, then that helps to get your own way sometimes. So sometimes, you know, when you, because I'm in Bodhnyana and I sit in between Ajahn Brahmali and Ajahn Brahm, you know, and I've been staying in that monastery since 1979, on and off, right? But I've been coming and going and spent a long time in other places. But Brahmali's been there the whole time, right? And sometimes I swear it's like an old married couple, you know, they're, you know. So Venerable Brahmali is very good at not letting Ajahn Brahm get away with things. Yeah? If he says one thing one day and another thing later on, Brahmali will pick him up on it. And yeah. So okay. So anyway, so this is one difference, right? So the difference between what, you know, do we just mind, you know, and we all know that this is something that's actually very common also in the lay community, that we all come along and we recite precepts having no idea what those precepts are, much less having a desire to keep them, right? We just recited the five precepts now. Did you all really mean to keep them? Yes? Ah, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yes? Four, yeah. So it's like in some place in Thailand, they're like, you know. They're just but, you know, I mean, frankly, a lot of places, they don't actually even know what they are. I mean, they just recite them. They don't have a translation or anything. It's just purely a mindless recitation. I mean, even in that case, you know, you can see it has a purpose. Like when, you know, if you go into the Thai villages and things like that, you might think, well, these people, they're all kind of drinking and they're all going fishing and they're all these things. Why are they coming and reciting the precepts? Well, how it works really is in the community, people understand that, but they... When they recite the precepts, it's not so much like we would understand like a sort of individual undertaking of the precepts, but it's more a communal affirmation of a set of shared values, right? So they're coming together as a community and they're saying, this is what we think is the right thing to do, yeah? Of course, I'm not going to actually do it, but I really respect those people who actually do it, right? So, I mean, it's not, you know, it's just one of those things anyway, you sort of get used to it. But this is that shift. And so, actually, you know, when I'm doing it in Australia, you know, we don't do the five precepts as part of a regular chanting thing. That we sort of only do it when people actually ask to take the five precepts. So, yeah. Another shift that we notice is the difference between in early Buddhism we have the idea of like multiple causes, multiple effects, and karma is just one of those kinds of causes, whereas very commonly in popular Buddhism these days, and even often enough taught in what should be more learned circles, but people think that karma is everything, so everything is caused by karma. I mean, I made that joke earlier, right? That the people on this side of the room, they had bad karma because the projector was flickering. But I mean, this is what people say, you know, karma has caused everything. And if you take that seriously, you would have to say that's actually right. You know, all of these people on this side of the room committed a projector flickering karma in their past life, which has come along and manifested and somehow magically made the projector flicker like that. I mean, it's completely mad, right? It means like everybody in this room has committed smartphone karma in their past life, right? So somehow, whatever, you know, a few decades ago, everybody in the world started doing karma that would magically produce smartphones, and suddenly we all have iPhones and stuff, which is great. But nobody in the past human civilization ever did that, right? I mean, this is just madness, right? Karma doesn't work that way. It doesn't kind of magically produce results, right? Karma is one of many causes that's playing out in conjunction with so many other different things, and social things, physical things, biological, physical, all kinds of stuff which is going on all around us all the time. So karma is an influence, but it doesn't determine things. So this is another point with the karma is malleable versus karma is deterministic. Okay, so again, there came to be this very kind of mechanistic idea of karma, So you have this idea, for example, you find in things like the Petavatu, Vimanavatu, where somebody will like offer some rice to a monk, and then when they do that, magically a heavenly mansion appears in the sky, waiting for them to go up to go to heaven, right? From that karma. And, you know, it's a very kind of almost quite childish understanding of actually what's happening, right? So again, the causes that we're making is just one kind of thing, right? I mean, the Buddha talked about karma in terms, for example, of sowing seed in a field, right? So, you know, the idea is if I go into a field and I sow rice seeds, well, I'm not going to get wheat, right? You can only get rice from that. But how much rice are you going to get? When exactly will it mature? How fertile will the soil be? When will the rains come? There are many things that will affect the yield and the outcome of that. But we do know that if you sow rice, you can only get rice back. And so the same thing in karma, you know that if you do good, then you can only get good back. If you do bad, you only get bad back. Yeah? But how that actually manifests will vary greatly depending on other conditions. Another thing which has changed a lot in the teaching is the idea that in the suttas, almost always it emphasizes about what is the karma that you do every day. Right? That's actually what matters. What's the important things? How do you live your life and what do you do every day? Whereas in the Buddhist tradition now, everyone talks about your last mind moment or your last thought moment determines your rebirth. It's complete madness, as if somehow you could just live your whole life one way and then have one thought at the end of your life and then suddenly there you go, or get reborn. It's complete madness. So this idea is not found in the early suttas at all. One thing to remember is that karma is not thought. Okay? Karma is an ethical choice, right? Which is different from a thought. Now we're having thoughts all the time, but we're not making ethical choices all the time, right? The thoughts just come and go, and they don't really have much of an effect, right? But when we make an ethical choice, that actually has an effect, right? We choose to do something good or something bad, it has an effect in our life, and that's the power of karma. But thoughts, they just come and they go, and they don't really do anything very much, right? It's a bit kind of white noise in the background. So that's not really what karma is. Now, if you look at, there's a couple of examples where the Buddha talked about somebody who did make some karma at the time of their death. It's always in a context where they made some kind of strong ethical choice at that time of death. So you have one example, he talks about a soldier, a warrior, who goes into battle, weapons upraised, mind full of hate, just wanting to kill his enemy, right? And then he gets killed, right? So in that time, yes, that karma will determine his rebirth, not because it's just a thought, right? But because his mind, at that time, he was actually making a very, very strong, powerful karma, yeah? And another example that's given on the opposite side, it talks about Dhananjani, the corrupt Brahmin, who was converted on his deathbed by Sariputta and developed Brahma Viharas and so on and gained faith and renounced the sort of the life of corruption that he'd lived up to then. And so because he completely changed his mind, he purified his mind on his deathbed, developed meditation and completely changed the way his mind was, then again that karma, you know, he created good karma at that time, which led to him getting a good rebirth. So it is possible to change your karma at the time of death, right? But these examples are not meant to show that every time that you die, somebody dies, that their last thought is determining their rebirth, right? The reality is that almost all the time, you're not actually making karma at the time that you die, right? Most people these days die in hospitals. What kind of karma are you making in the hospital? You're just lying there. You're not doing anything. And most people, their minds are very feeble at that time. You know, they maybe have some painkillers or something like that, and they're just like, they're not really making any karma. Yeah? So that, you know, that's not really going to affect anything. Or else people might die of an accident, you know. And again, you're not, you know, maybe you're just driving down to the corner shop to pick up some milk. You know, you're not really making any karma by doing that, right? It's a fairly neutral action. It's neither particularly good nor particularly bad. And then maybe you have a car crash and you die. So at that time, you're not really making any karma, so that doesn't really affect you. But it's only if it happens to be the case that you're really making some strong karma. Maybe you dive into a burning building to save a child from it, yeah? And so at that time, because you have that really strong, wholesome intention, maybe you die during that effort, but you get a good rebirth because of it. So it's only in those few extraordinary circumstances that that will happen. So in each of these cases, we can see a kind of a common thread that the teachings we find in early Buddhism, in my view, are much more reasonable, much more moderate, and much more balanced, and that these things often became exaggerated, there's an absolutism that crept into it. And also, I think we find a strong influence of non-Buddhist teachings in some of these things, especially from the Hindu and Jaina traditions. Things which the Buddha himself rejected and argued against in the early suttas, but which sort of gradually crept back in because of the influence of the Indian culture that was surrounding them. For example, the idea that karma is a condition for everything is a Jaina idea which has crept back into Buddhism and into Hinduism. So again, this can be one of the benefits of studying early Buddhist teachings on ethics, is to help to clarify and to be able to criticize and improve our understanding of these very important ideas in ethics, because, you know, ethics is an important topic, right? How do we live our lives? And if we can base our ethics on something which is more reasonable, more moderate, more rational, then I think that's something which is really helpful. So that's a quick introduction on that. Is there any questions before we move on? Yes.
Hello, Bhante. Can I clarify? I was told that as a Buddhist, if you have the right intention, basically you already earn like half good karma.
Sorry?
If you already have attentions to do it, but you don't do it, you already earn like half good karma.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly half, but sure. Yeah, I mean, there's something to that. I mean, if you have an intention to do something, then that's already some good karma. But of course, if you actually follow through and do it, then it's making even stronger good karma. Yeah. So you think about that like in the context of meditation, right? So you can have the intention to meditate.
No, like
and that's already pretty good, yeah?
Like attention to do five precepts, for example.
Right, exactly, yes. So, you know, and that's fair enough. That's life, isn't it? We don't always do what we intend to do. So you might take the precepts very sincerely, and then later on you break them. That's okay. You know, you come back and you take them again. Yeah, we all make mistakes. It's not meant to be sort of fixed things that it's life, you know. They're like a guidelines and encouragement, something to aspire to. You can try that one at work next time. Boss says, did you do that work I gave you?
Yeah.
Well, I had the intention.
Just a follow up of a question. Now, in the legal world, if you do something without intention, you are punished. You know? For example, you crash into someone and you're wrong, but you don't have the intent to crash into them, the law will still come after you. If you kill someone and didn't have the intention to kill him, the law will still come after you, but of a lesser kind
right.
of punishment. But so, is it the same as karma, or is it totally different from this sort of
Well, the Vinaya is similar to that, because in the Vinaya also intention is a factor sometimes, and it's not a factor in other cases. So, for example, typically in the Vinaya, usually intention is more relevant for serious things. So, for example, one of the monks' rules is that we shouldn't eat after noon, right? But if I do eat after noon, but I don't have the intention to, for example, I get the time wrong, and I get my time zones confused, then I still fall into an offence, even though I didn't have any intention to break that rule in that particular case. Whereas there are many other cases where you won't fall into an offence, right? So this is one that Ajahn Brahm brought up in his Vinaya classes. He said, "What if you're a monk who's also an assassin, okay? And you're a sniper." And you're sitting there and you've got your gun trained, and there's two people walking along, road, right? And you want to kill one of them, okay? And you're focusing and you're aiming very carefully. You've got the bullet trained on the head. You squeeze the trigger, okay? The gun fires, and one of those men drops down dead. But you're not guilty of a parajika offence. You're not guilty of the offence of deliberately killing a human being. Why is that? You shot the wrong guy. Exactly. Yeah? I meant to kill this one. I actually killed the other one. Yeah? Yeah? So, phew, I can get out of it that time. Yeah. So this is how these things can be very tricky. Yeah? So that similar principle can apply, that sometimes if you have an offence, if you have intention, it's more serious. I mean, in that case, it's still an offence, but it's not a parajika offence if you kill someone else. So one of the things also of course, it's difficult to determine intention. Right? So it's often difficult for a person to know their own intentions, right? Much less to know that in a court or something like that, yeah? And of course people will very readily lie about their intentions. I mean, in the Vinaya we tend to make more of an assumption that people are likely to tell the truth, right? But so this is why sometimes for practical purposes, yeah, then intention is a bit difficult to deal with, yeah, but certainly as much as possible, we rely on intention as being an important part of that.
Ajahn, just now you mentioned that karma is not just about thought or it's not thoughts. Then why is it that we have to make such intense efforts to guide ourselves against unwholesome thoughts where it is not part of karma? Because I thought that unwholesome thoughts is part of karma in the sense that if you have ill will, desire, etc., this is part of the karmic effect that subsequently that you will have to borrow.
Sure. Okay, well there's two different kind of aspects here. One is the aspect that we're talking here in the context of ethics, right? Yeah? So in the context of ethics and making karma, it's a relatively coarse context. And the problem that we have is that people tend to conflate something which is much more subtle, right? Which is the development of your mind in meditation, right? And so you tend to confuse that with what we're talking about here, which is at a much more basic level. Okay? So intention at this basic level in terms of making good karma and bad karma is something that everyone does, and everybody can train themselves to do good karma. You don't have to be a meditator to do that. Yeah? So learning proper meditation, of course, you're taking it to a higher level. By doing the meditation itself, you're making even much stronger good karma. Okay? Because you have the intention to purify your mind. Yeah? But those individual thoughts aren't going to have any particular bad effect. What they will do, of course, is they'll get you reborn. Right? So as long as you're not able to let go of the greed, hatred, and delusion which is underlying those things, you'll get reborn, right? So obviously it has effects. But it's not like, you know, if you're sitting there and you think, oh, that person was really annoying today, that somehow this is that's going to make you get reborn in some lower realm or anything like that. That's not how it works, yeah? You know, if you have to actually either physically or verbally do something, right, to make it a karma, like you actually speak out of anger or do something out of anger, or if it's purely a mental karma, then, you know, you have to, like, conceive some kind of plan, right, or actually have some like an obsessive train of thought or something that's a very kind of strong intention, right? You know, the next time I see that person, I'm going to really give them a piece of my mind, you know, something like that. And you actually buy into it and have that plan, and then that's something that will create that bad karma. Otherwise, it's just kind of white noise. It just kind of comes and goes and doesn't have much effect at that level, that ethical level. Okay. So it's important not to confuse these things. Yeah? The level of ethics you know, it shouldn't, you shouldn't need to be a meditation expert in order to be able to live a good life. Yeah? So don't, it's not that difficult. Yeah.
Bhante, the suttas do seem to draw a distinction between very gross karma, which you talked of, that has really strong ethical consequences, but they, at the same time, they also talk about the really subtle types of karma, and they use the terms anusaya and the verb anusati. And the Chetana Suttas in the Nidana Samhita say that even if you don't pakupeti or chetati, you don't right. plot or intend, right. but you anusati, that will drive rebirth.
You'll still get reborn, yeah. Yeah. So, but again, that's at an existential level, like that kind of very subtle level. But it's not like that one thought is going to make you get reborn in a particular place. But it's the fact that you haven't been able to let go of greed, hatred and delusion means you're still in the round of samsara. Okay? But having said which, anusaya is not karma. Okay, and anusaya is not karma, it's not even subtle karma. Anusaya is one of the things which can be a cause of making karma.
Well, it's a sankara.
Not in that sense, no.
No, I think it's sankara in the sense of, in the 12 nidanas you have...
Anusaya belongs to the defilements, yeah? So the defilements are what underlies karma. Okay? So in the early Buddhism you always have a distinction between there's threefold distinction, right, which you find through dependent origination and many different places. One of them is that in the commentaries what they call them is the kilesa vata, the kama vata and the vipaka vata. Right? So the kilesa vata is the underlying roots of things, right? So greed, hatred and delusion, anusaya and so on. And then karma is the actions which are motivated by those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then the vipaka is the results of those things. And so you find that actually throughout the suttas. In the Jains, those two are the same. So for the Jains, karma and kilesa are the same. The word asava, for example, in Jainism is a synonym of karma. Okay? Whereas in Buddhism it's not. So asava is an underlying cause, right? Motivation, which can result in karma being made. But it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, it's just that I find it strange that, you know, SN 12.3 it actually discusses anusati together with pakapeti and chatati, and
that's right. So you can have you have the kamas, right? So you have those three, pakapeti and chatati, which are the actual kama, the active force, right? That's the later, more developed stage. So even if those things are not in place, right? So there isn't actually any kama being made. There's just the anusaya. Yeah? So even then, you're still in the round of rebirth. You haven't escaped from rebirth because you need to get rid of the anusaya. Okay?
Oh no, I think I know where the confusion lies now. Because let's take the latent tendency to aversion, patika nusaya, and it says it's said to drive the mental karma of grief. So
right.
would it be correct to say that the anusaya is like the mula, the thing that causes the grief to come out?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so by itself, it's harmless if it doesn't find expression.
Well, it's not that it's harmless. It still keeps you getting reborn, but it's not making particular karmas, right? See, the thing is also that, again, it's this thing about whether how deterministic things are, right? Now, actually, you can flip, and this is one of the things in dependent origination, you can actually flip your defilements into making good karma, right? So when, for example, you're talking to somebody and they really annoy you and you get really angry, right? And you can actually have mindfulness. Oh, hang on, I'm getting angry here. I should do something to overcome this anger. You're still angry, right? You haven't overcome it yet. But you say, oh, please, here, have this present. You know, let me open the door for you. Can I do something nice for you? And you do that, not because you feel kindness for them, but because you feel anger for them. Right? And because you've got enough wisdom and mindfulness to know that you should do something to overcome it. So even though the actual underlying motivation, the force, is bad, right? Because you can have mindfulness and so on, you can actually still make good karma. Yeah, conditioned by that. It's not the anger which is causing the good karma, right? It's the wisdom and mindfulness that's causing the good karma, right? But the anger can still be an indirect prompt or stimulus for that. Yeah? And so, Yeah, so this is why, again, this, I think that in Buddhism it's a more flexible psychology as opposed to Jainism, where those things are identical.
Thanks, Bhante.
Yeah. But, you know, that's actually one of those interesting suttas for that context, yeah. Okay, any others? Questions before we move on? Okay, let's do 5 minutes meditation. For the next few days, we're going to look at some of the different aspects. The scope that we're going to be looking at is the purpose of ethics. So why we keep precepts and so on. The basis of ethics and the practice of ethics. I should just make a little note. I'm using here the word ethics to translate the word sila. It's a little bit problematic. I'm not quite sure what the best translation of sila is. I think in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, he usually uses virtue, which is quite nice. Except, I'm not entirely. I use ethics. Ethics is a kind of a secular term to talk about morality, and I quite liked ethics because it's a bit more scientific the way that they talk about it. But I liked the word ethics until I spent a year sitting on an ethics committee, and then I didn't like it anymore. Because I found that what's actually practiced in terms of what ethics is very thin. It's very shallow, right? I did this ethics committee. It was in the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, and we were a human research ethics committee. So every couple of months we'd have a meeting and we'd look at research proposals and so on, and then decide whether it was allowed to go ahead, you know. So are you allowed to, you know, sew two heads onto one body or something like that? No, we didn't have anything like that. Most of them were fairly benign. And, you know, it's like new drugs come up or something like that, and there's a sort of testing, so on. And basically what it boiled down to a lot, you know, in modern times, when you talk about ethics, basically what it boils down is to what is no one going to object to very much, yeah? And it's all kind of how do we actually get things through without upsetting anybody, and that's really all that ethics is. It's a very kind of minimal requirement, whereas ethics or sila in Buddhism is much more to it. It's much fuller. You know, there's like an aspiration. You know, it's like a guide for you to live. You know, how can you actually live a better life? So there's a strength to it. Sila in general, when it's used in the early texts, is also a bit broader. It's used to refer to ethics, but it's also used in a more general sense to talk about conduct. So things that are not necessarily ethical as such would also come within the range of sila. So, for example, an obvious example would be something like etiquette. Yeah? So, like, you know, table manners and dressing properly and all of those kinds of things. It's not really ethics, but it certainly comes within what we would call sila. So sila is sort of somewhat broader. It includes those things which are like intentional choices to do good and bad, but it also includes more than that. But mostly what we're going to be focusing on for this course is the more important part of sila, which is actually, of course, the ethical choices, what to do good or to do bad. So that's the ethics. So the purpose of ethics, why do we do it and so on? What's the basis of ethics? How do we know what's right and wrong? Right? This is something that's very important. And also practice, how do we actually do it? So let's look at each of these in a little bit more detail. The purpose of ethics, why do we keep ethics, right? Again, do you do it just so that you can, not be criticized by your neighbors or something like that? Well, that's one reason for doing it, I guess. But the suttas, of course, give many reasons for keeping ethical precepts. Some of them are reasons that are apparent here and now. Others are much more distant, much more subtle. But probably the most important reasons which the suttas give for keeping ethical precepts is, first of all, happiness. Yeah? If you keep ethical precepts, you're happy because you don't have remorse about what you do. You can be confident with wherever you are. You're not ashamed, and you know this aspect of happiness. I studied ethics at university, and nobody mentioned happiness, right? There's no mention of happiness. Interesting. And so this is a problem in ethics, the way that it's studied in universities, because you see the problem is that happiness is psychological, right? And that's in the next door, right? So we're in the philosophy department and we do ethics and they do happiness next door, right? And this is how things work in universities. So they're not quite happy to talk about happiness because it's a psychological thing and it's somebody else's job, right? I mean, it's not quite as bad as that, but this is the kind of tendency. So actually that notion of happiness and ethics is, it's a bit difficult to draw that. But you see, the psychologists don't like to talk about ethics either, right? So the ethicists don't like to talk about happiness, and the psychologists don't like to talk about ethics, right? Because the psychologists are always terrified of Godspeak, right? So if you want to understand Western psychology, you have to understand they're terrified of religion, right? So Western psychology began by kind of divorcing itself from religion and saying, no, we're a separate kind of discipline, right? And so anything which sounds vaguely religious-y, wishy-washy something-something, is very hard, right? So in psychologists are always very non-judgmental, yes. And yes, what did you do? Well, yes, I had a dream last night and so on and so forth, and then I woke up and then I went and killed three people and so on. Oh, yes, well, and how did that make you feel? Yeah. And so, I mean, that's an extreme example, but that relationship between ethics and happiness is something which I don't think has got as much attention as it should do. I mean, there are some things which have studied it, but actually from a Buddhist point of view, that's really basic. We do good, we feel good. We do bad, we feel bad. Yeah. The reason I'm hesitating, whenever I come to that, I can never forget. There was a skit in a comedy program which I'm sure nobody here saw. It's called Australia, You're Standing in It, which was very popular in the 80s. And they had the favourite characters on the pop program were Tim and Debbie, who were very alternative progressive types, but they weren't nearly as bright as they thought they were. And they had one of their conversations where. We seem to have been glitching a little bit here. One of their conversations where we have something. Yes, we have that at the top. Anyway, Debbie is saying how rich people aren't really happy. And they earn all this money and things like that, and they're not really happy. And Tim says, well, on my way here, I saw this guy driving this really nice Mercedes, and he looked pretty happy. Debbie's like, no, he wasn't really happy. And Tim's like, well, you know, he's pulling this boat behind him, and, you know, I don't know, he looked pretty happy. Debbie's like, he couldn't have been really happy. So this is one of the problems, of course, is that sometimes bad people seem kind of happy, don't they? Right? It's very annoying, yeah. And sometimes you do all good things, and you don't feel happy at all. Yeah? So that's these things are not obvious. But actually, this is one of the things which the Buddha talked about when talking about karma, was about how we shouldn't rush to conclusions, and we shouldn't jump to simplistic conclusions about things. Obviously, you know, how someone feels in the short term might be very different from how they are in the long term, yeah? So if a thief breaks into a bank and they all steal money, they probably feel very good at that moment, yeah? They're all very happy, but then, of course, they get thrown in jail and they probably don't feel very happy anymore. So while this is a kind of a general principle, right, remember that how this works out will always differ in different places, and that doesn't affect our understanding of the overall principle. Where are we? Happiness. You know, think about this. A good comparison is the concept of gravity, right? Now, gravity is one of the most obvious physical things, right? You drop something and it falls down. Yeah? We don't think about it too much, right? And we don't sort of get up in the morning and think, oh, I'm floating off. Gravity mustn't be working very well today. It's pretty kind of reliable, right? Right? Except, of course, there's problems. What about clouds? Birds, right? What about the moon and the sun? How do they hang there? Yeah? And, of course, this is actually very weird. Like, why is it that some things fall down, but other things seem to stay up? Now, of course, we think we understand the law of gravity and so on, but it took until the time of Newton to actually figure this out and actually work out that the same forces and principles that are governing the behavior of that little bottle cap when it falls down is actually the same thing that keeps the moon from falling down. Yeah? It doesn't have to be another principle, but it applies in different ways. We can expand our frame of reference, and we can see that it actually works in that way. So it's the same thing with karma. So we can see in a limited sphere that when you do good, you feel good. If you do bad, you feel bad. Yeah? And even though there might seem like there are all these exceptions, right? But when our understanding is deeper and our framework is bigger, we actually see that those exceptions come within that bigger framework. Yeah? So as well as leading to happiness here and now, if we do good karma, live a good life, then we get reborn in a good rebirth, which also is good. So, or alternatively, if we do bad, we go to a bad place. And finally, ethics is a support for awakening, for realization of nibbana. Important to understand that in early Buddhism there's no dichotomy between these things, and this is something that we find sometimes people say, and people sometimes say that even of early Buddhism, right? They'll say that there's these two different aspects in early Buddhism. One is to get a good rebirth, and the other one is to get enlightened. And I think that's very wrong. I disagree with that. Of course those two aspects are there, but they're not like two different things, right? They're more like different stages or more sort of levels of maturity of the path. I mean, all of it is just practicing the Eightfold Path, and the outcome of practicing the Eightfold Path is always Nibbana. That's where it leads to. And so you might think, oh, I'm just doing this good deed because I want to be happy. That's fine, right? But actually it will lead to Nibbana anyway, right? Maybe you'll do a good deed and you'll do some offering of dana because you think, oh, I want to go to heaven, right? That's fine, you can do that. But whether you like it or not, it's actually a cause for you to get to Nibbana, yeah? Eventually, yeah? Nothing you can do about it, right? Right? So even if that's not what you're actually thinking of at the time, the reality is that you're still practicing letting go, you're still practicing generosity, you're still practicing kindness, and these things are wearing away those unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? And that's what Nibbana is, ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. So anything that you're doing to overcome those things will be leading towards awakening. So, so this is, again, one of the reasons I think why that conception of ethics in Buddhism is very rich. You know, it's not just a set of laws so you can sort of get by. It's not just being able to live with people without annoying them too much. It's not just doing what God says or something like that, but you actually have a conception that this way of living is something that leads to a happiness, it leads to a fullness, it leads to a spiritual development and growth. And this is something, as I said, I studied ethics in university, and I've never heard anything like this. Like when I first came to Buddhism and I heard the Buddha's teachings on ethics, it was completely a new way of looking at it. It had never occurred to me that the purpose of living ethically, was such an abundant purpose to it. Any questions on that? The purpose of ethics before we go on? Yes.
I just want to talk about happiness. Huh? It is a very relative thing. To some people, like you say, may be a happy thing, and another people might be not happy. So meaning that if you are deluded, you still is you're feeling good, you're feeling happy. And if you do good, you're deluded, you might feel bad and not happy. So how do you define happiness? Because it's a very relative thing. See? And it's also a very dualistic thing in this world. When you have happiness, it must come with sadness somehow. So I'm not sure whether I framed my question
correctly,
right, but this is what I'm trying to.
Yeah, exactly. And this is I think is the point. And this actually came across. You may have heard of Peter Singer, the Australian ethical philosopher, and we actually went to a lecture of his. A couple of years ago, happened to be in Melbourne at the time that he was visiting and gave a lecture, so we went along. And one of my friends who was there, who's herself is a philosopher, sort of asked him about this particular question and tried to sort of get him to give a satisfactory answer. And it was interesting that he really couldn't give a satisfactory answer on this. You know, even Peter Singer, who you know is often regarded as the most influential and famous of the modern of the living ethical philosophers, and basically he stumbled over this point that if you're going to relate ethics to happiness, which he does, okay, so he's a utilitarian philosopher, then you have to also explain what happiness is, right? And this is of course this problem. Well, that's the job of the psychologists, not of the ethicists, yeah. And so trying to sort of draw him out on this was quite difficult. Right? So ultimately you've got this kind of gap in there. Whereas, of course, in Buddhism, you have quite a detailed psychology of ethics, right? The Buddha wasn't concerned about the walls between the departments and the universities, right? He didn't really care about this. And so as well as giving the ethical teachings, he also gave the teachings on happiness and talked about the different kinds of happiness that we have. And talked about, for example, if you do keep your precepts and you have what they call an avajja sutta, the blameless happiness, yeah? And so the different kinds of happiness which you can have, which are talked about in a lot of detail in different aspects throughout the suttas, yeah? But one of the distinctions that we can make, which is a nice one, is we can make a distinction between happiness as a pleasant feeling, right, and happiness as a sense of meaning, right? And the ancient Greeks made this distinction as well. They called hedonic happiness and eudaimonic happiness. Right? So eudaimonic happiness is a happiness of having meaning, right? And that's also something which is actually kind of really important as well. Yeah? And one of the things that Western psychology has shown is that hedonic happiness doesn't lead to the happiness of meaning, right? One of them doesn't lead to the other. In fact, for example, it's a basic law of diminishing returns, right? So you have a plate of ice cream and that gives you a certain amount of happiness. You have another plate that's a lot less, and by the third plate you're starting to have significant unhappiness, yeah? And the reality is, and all of the studies in psychology have shown, that simply having more pleasant feelings doesn't lead to having a happier life. Okay? I mean, to a certain degree it does, right? Obviously, if you don't have enough to eat and so on, then you need those things. So there's a certain basic proportion that does. But beyond that, having more pleasant feelings doesn't make you actually have a happier life. What does make you have a happier life is having a sense of meaning. Yeah? And so this is where that sense of understanding the context of ethics comes in, right? So sometimes when you do what is good, you can experience a lot of unhappiness because of it, right? So for example, what happens if you're at work, right, and your boss is cheating and stealing money, right? What do? Do what everyone else does and pretend not to notice, right? Or do you talk about it? Do you become the whistleblower, right? Yeah, whistleblowers have a lot of suffering. Yeah, a lot, right? I mean, you might not be as badly off as Edward Snowden or something like that, and get exiled and so on. But you're likely to be pretty unpopular. You're likely to go through a lot of stress and a lot of suffering. Yeah, but inside you ask yourself, is it worth it? Right? And you say, well, actually, I did what I thought was right. Yeah. So you have that sense that actually, do you regret it? No, I don't. I suffered a lot, but it was the right thing to do. Yeah? So, so this is kind of idea. You find this in the suttas and so on, talks about as well. You know, the idea that you can sacrifice a short-term pleasure for the sake of a greater good and a greater pleasure. Yeah. Yeah.
Ajahn, thanks for sharing the happiness part. I think in terms of the natural happiness, at least we still can feel it and have good grasp on the ideas. Let's say talk about rebirth. Mm-hmm. Even though somebody can recall their past life, doesn't mean they can validate there's such a thing called rebirth, and not to talk about even awakening, how we could through practice help ourselves relate to that eventual goal of like having a better rebirth, or eventually we can get enlightened. Because this, all these things we cannot really access to it unless you are highly developed spiritually. But let's say for a learner, in terms of like we're trying to learn along the way, how can we actually get access to that idea that we are actually moving in the right directions, like getting a better rebirth or moving towards the direction of having awakening?
Yeah, well, basically it comes down to faith at that point. Yeah, so there's an interesting dialogue where Siha General comes to the Buddha and says, Lord Buddha, what is the benefit of generosity? Right? And he gives like five benefits of generosity or something. I can't remember what they are now, that you feel confident in the assemblies and people like you and so on and so forth. And then the last one he said was that you get a good rebirth. Yeah? And see how the general gave a very interesting response to that. He says, you know, that first benefit that you talked about, I can see that because I'm a generous person and I can see the results of that. And the second and third and fourth ones, I can also see those. But that last one that you mentioned, I can't see that, so I guess I just have to take that on faith. And the Buddha said, yeah, you're right, you can't see that, so you just have to take it on faith. Yeah? So there is that that element of faith which is there, but it's an akaravati sadha. We talked about yesterday in the Upanaka Sutta. Yeah? It's a reasoned faith. Right? It's not a blind faith or an irrational faith. Right? So we can still, even though we might not have sort of direct access to rebirth or anything like that, but we can still look at what evidence there is. We can look at what, see whether it makes sense as an idea and so on. So we can still investigate and reflect on it. So we have a reasoned faith. But at the same time, we accept that, well, maybe not. Yeah? Yeah. But it is true that even though these purposes are mentioned very often in the suttas, but it's also the case that in the suttas, the Buddha very clearly made the point that you don't have to believe in rebirth in order to have a good ethics, right? So he didn't hang his ethics off the idea of rebirth, right? So whether you believe in rebirth or not, and he would give plenty of good reasons for living a good life. Again, we saw that kind of argument yesterday in the Upanaka Sutta. And we find similar things elsewhere as well. Okay. There's a little lamb. Isn't that cute? Tasty. That is so terrible. Oh my goodness. How can you look at that cute little lamb and him? Yeah, it's too skinny anyway. I just put some pictures in there just to make people laugh, that's all. There's no greater purpose for it, so. Why do we think about ethics? Why do we reflect on it and so on? So some of the purposes of doing what we're doing here, you know, I mean, after all, you know, we get by most of the time, don't we? We sort of make choices and we do things that are right and wrong, and sometimes we don't know and so on. So why do we bother reflecting on ethical theory? Well, there are a number of reasons. One reason is the relationship between intuition and reason. Ethics is not completely rational, and you can never work it out completely rationally, okay? If you study ethics and ethical philosophy, then you'll always find that there are lots of dilemmas, and especially in Western ethics, they love to come up with dilemmas about, you know, that will tend to confuse your ethical intuition. So you think that something should be the right thing to do, but it ends up being the wrong thing to do, and how do you figure that out? And so you can never completely reason everything out, right? But you can do some things, right? So you can reflect meaningfully about some kinds of things. You can clarify some kinds of situations. You can clear up some kinds of doubts, okay? And through using your wisdom like that, it can allow your intuition to flourish. I mentioned the other day about the use of inference in Buddhism, right? And so what I meant by inference
often inference appears as a kind of intuition. So when you might say you're wrestling with some kind of ethical problem. Let's say that one I just mentioned before. You know, do you become the whistleblower at work if your boss is stealing money from the firm? And so you can kind of think about it. You can rationalize it. You can say, well, if I say something, then this will happen. This will happen. This will happen. I risk losing my job. I've got the mortgage on my home. You know, how can I support my family if I lose my job, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, if I don't say anything, I become complicit. Right? I'm helping him to cover it up, and so, and I'm living in a firm where we're making wrong livelihood because we're stealing money from people, and so on and so forth. So you can actually reason things out to some degree, and sometimes you can look at that, and that can help you to clarify, right? But then afterwards, there's a role also for intuition to play a part, and the best way to hone that intuition is through meditation. You do all that reasoning and so on, and then you just go and you sit, and you don't think about it. You don't try to work out the answer to the problem. You forget about it. You don't worry about it. You put it to one side. You make your mind clear, make your mind peaceful. And then, when you're not expecting it, the answer will come to you. Right? And it will just arise. Where does it arise from? Who knows? Right? Intuition and the arising of knowledge is one of the most mysterious things. It happens to us all the time, and yet we never reflect about how mysterious it is. I'll give you an example. What's 2 plus 2? 4. Okay, where did that come from? Where did the answer 4 come from? Does anyone know? Sorry? Rotate learning. Rote learning? Okay, well, what's 616 plus 4. Also, Lenny, have you learnt that particular problem before? You must have a very strange education system here in Singapore. There's a principle behind it, but you didn't learn that. It's not a memory. It's something you just made up new. Yeah. But when we say these things, I mean, that's what people often say, is memory or something like that. But that's just a word that you use to cover up the reality of what's happening, right? What actually happens is that the answer is not there, and then it is, right? You can use the word memory or something like that, but that's just a word that you use it. But the fact is, the answer isn't there one moment, and then it is. Where does it come from? I don't know. Sorry? Man created it. Okay, look, fair enough. I mean, but that's a slightly different point. You know, the point is that in your mind, when the answer comes to you in your mind, where does it come from? And it just appears. It's weird. The more you look at it, it's so weird. So what happens in your mind? Things just happen. Somebody asks you a question. Like I'm sitting here, right? I find this very, very weird, right? I'm supposed to be a teacher of Buddhism, yeah? Apparently. Right? And this happens to me so often, like before a Dhamma talk or something like that. And I look into my mind and I think, what am I going to talk about? And I'm like, how can I fill up an hour with stuff about Buddhism? There's nothing. I don't know anything about Buddhism. I look into my mind and I don't know anything. Right? It's just not there. Nothing is there. Right now, there's nothing in my mind that knows anything about Buddhism. It's kind of a worry, right? But then somehow when you need it, it comes. Yeah? Well, most of the time, occasionally it doesn't. It's a bit embarrassing. Most of the time it comes. So it's very strange, isn't it, that intuition, yeah? And so this is one of the reasons why meditation is so powerful, because it clarifies your mind, yeah? And it allows that intuitive knowledge to come to the fore. And one of the qualities that intuitive knowledge has, right, the deeper it is that it comes with a sense of certainty, right? It's not just like a computer flashing up the number 4, right? It has an emotional sense to it, right? There's a sense of rightness, right? Now, that sense of rightness is not always 100%, right? Sometimes you think you've got the right answer and you don't, yeah? But most of the time, you have this intuitive sense when you've got the answer, don't you? Yeah, it's actually, and it feels good,
Right? It's a positive emotion. Knowing things, having the answer is good. Yeah. So when you're faced with this dilemma, this is really the best way to approach it. Yeah. So we, and by doing the course and reflecting on it and studying it, we're training our minds beforehand, because when it actually happens, you'll be caught up in so many emotions and so many forces pulling you one way or the other that it's very difficult to stop and to get some distance and to figure out what you should be doing. Okay? So we train ourselves beforehand by reflecting on it and doing examples and things like that, so that when it actually happens in the real world, we can hopefully be a bit more sane about the choices that we make. Yeah? So, but just remember that twofold process. If you really need to work out the answer to an ethical dilemma that you're in, those two things. First of all, just try to think about it reasonably and rationally. Figure out all of the different aspects of it and try to clarify them as much as you can, and then forget everything. You go away, you sit in meditation, and just wait. And sooner or later, the answer will come to you. Okay? The other aspect that it's talking about here is, in Buddhism, we have the aspect of positive ethics. The idea of positive ethics meaning that ethics is not just things to not do, but what should be done. Yeah, and there's a big difference between the two. And often in Buddhism, we have a lot of negative ethics, especially in Theravada Buddhism, that you say, I will not do something. Okay. And so we just recited the five precepts, right? I will not kill any living beings, I will not do this, I will not do that. Now that, okay, that's fine as far as it goes, but that's very limited, right? That doesn't tell you anything about how you should live your life. Yeah? It doesn't tell you anything about what is the best thing for you to do. Yeah? And it's interesting, in modern times it's become kind of quite famous that Thich Nhat Hanh has sort of invented these, what does he call, the five mindfulness trainings or something like that. And he sort of revised the five precepts and sort of made them much more positive, right? Which is fine, but I find it kind of curious, because that's what you actually find in the early suttas. So I'm not sure why he felt the need to sort of say, oh, we needed positive precepts, because that's actually what you find in the suttas all the time. Speech that is wise, speech that is going to the heart, speech that is pleasing to the ear, saying things that reconcile those who are divided, speech which is meaningful, which is at the right time, which is speech on the Dhamma and Vinaya. Yeah? And so many places that the Buddha described a positive way of using speech and using all of those other precepts. Yeah? The precept against not killing, it says, one abides with a heart full of compassion for all sentient beings. Yeah? So it's not just refraining from killing, yeah? But it's that it's actually calling you to live the best possible life. Yeah? And finally, the other important thing about ethics and to considering it and reflecting on it is because we realize and we give ourselves the confidence that these things can be done. Okay, this is one of the things that the Buddha said. And the Buddha said, I do not ask you to do anything that's impossible. Right? If it were not possible to do these things, I wouldn't ask you to do it. Right? But it is possible. And that's why I ask you to do it. So when we're always making these excuses for ourselves, just remember that. Yeah? The Buddha didn't ask us to do impossible things. Yeah? He asked us to do what is possible. So if we're thinking that, it can't be done, it's impossible, maybe it's something that we're missing out on. Maybe we need to look at it in another way. Maybe there's an angle on it. Maybe we need to try harder. Right? Maybe there's something we don't understand. And sometimes these things, they seem, you know, they seem so absurd. I'll just give you one example. I had one of my supporters in Malaysia was a businessman. He used to run an IT company. He was the CEO. And one time he was going to Bangkok. He flew to Bangkok to do sign a contract. And he met with a group of businessmen, and they said they went to have a meeting in a nightclub. Right? And so they go to the nightclub and they all sort of have a drink. So they all sit around the table and they all have a drink. And he said, look, I'm, you know, just that's fine. I'll just have soda water. I'm keeping the five precepts. And then they all had a hookah, right? So they all have a girl for the night. And this is sort of part of the deal, right? You sign the contract, and then you all have a hookah for the night. And I said to him, is this kind of normal practice in business circles? He said, yeah, that's pretty much. I said, what if one of the business people is a woman? Well, they get a gigolo for her. You know, what's the problem? They're adaptable. Anyway, fine, whatever. And so he says, look, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm happily married, so there's no need for that. And, you know, they said to him, you know, this, if you don't, we're all doing this together, yeah? So if you don't do it, then no contract, okay? So no drink, no girl, no contract, right? So that contract was worth $7 million, yeah? So he was effectively being offered $7 million to get drunk and have sex. Which most people would think was a pretty good deal, right? Yeah. And so he said, oh, well, thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. And he walked out and he went back to his hotel. Had a good night's sleep. In the morning, there was a knock on the door, and they appeared, and they said, okay, here's the contract, sign it. Right? So interesting psychology going on there. Like why did they want him to sign to do that with them? Well, because obviously that proved that they all had dirt on each other, right? They all knew that they were as corrupt as each other, and they're all part of that same kind of gang. So it's like a bonding thing, right? And if he's not bonding, then he's not part of the gang, right? So that's an understandable psychology, and that's why they didn't want him to do it. But then later on, when he walked out like that, imagine what's going on in their minds, right? They're thinking to themselves, this guy is absolutely incorruptible, right? He is never going to cheat us, right? He is never going to misquote us. He is never going to do, you know, if he says he'll do it, he'll do it. He'll be a completely honest person. Wow, they've probably never actually encountered that before in their business careers, right? Somebody they can actually trust, right? And so then you begin to realize actually these precepts have a power to them. And so often, you know, we think that, oh, we need to break them for one reason or another and so on. And it's kind of but if we have that strength to just have the confidence to keep it, then usually we find that things will work out very well. Yeah. Uh-huh. God did the same thing, did he?
Hello. My friend tells me that this statement, I would not ask you to do anything that's not possible. If I didn't think it was possible, and she says that's something she says, that's something God says.
Okay.
So, are they copying from the Buddhist?
Oh, obviously, yeah. God's learning from Buddha. Yeah, why not? Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Okay. Do we have another question? No. Yes, no. Okay, next one. Intentions, the roots of ethics. So we talked about intentions earlier, but what do we actually mean by intention? So the basic idea is that we have an intention for the good of oneself and others. What underlies our intention, one way of thinking about it is underlying the intention is a motivation, right? So we talked a little bit about that earlier with that difference, like the kind of underlying thing which provokes action and choices is what we can call the motivation, and this is the level where there's either the defilements or the lack of defilements, but then the actual choices that we want to make, right? So you can think, for example, I might have a motivation, I want to help poor children, right? So I have this desire that's a good thing to do. I hate to see children not having good enough food and enough education, so I want to do something about that. So then I decide to make some kind of act based on that, right? So I give to some charity or to do some work to help or something like that. So that's a karma which is based on that kind of motivation. So we should, you know, we need to. It's not easy to discern intentions and motivations. So that's something that can often be clarified through meditation. But one thing I think that is important, and something that I see quite a lot in Western countries, I'm not sure if it's so true in Asian countries, probably is, I guess, but a lot of time people second guess their motivations and other people's motivations, right? So we think, oh, we're doing this, but why are we doing it? And there's like a suspicion of doing good, yeah? And I think, you know, yes, it's important to understand your motivations and things, but don't be too worried about it, right? Don't be second guessing your motivations. If something's a good thing to do, then it's good, yeah? And just trust that. Yeah, unless you've got a reason for second guessing it, yeah. Ethics is typically not black and white. I mean, obviously there are some things that are black and white, but very often the things that matter and the things that are difficult are not black and white. And so we have to get used to living in a world, right, where we're dealing with all kinds of shades of grey. So this is a part of growing up, right? It's a part of becoming an adult. You know, when you're a kid, you don't know anything about what's right and what's wrong, and mummy says, don't do this, don't do that, and then gradually you learn. But then sometimes there's something which mummy or daddy has told you, never do that, and then you see they're doing it, right? So they'll tell you don't lie, and then you catch them out lying, right? And so that's basically what happens to us through adolescence, right? We realize that our parents aren't perfect, right? And, you know, we become very critical, right, sometimes. How can they do that? And it's very hypocritical and so on. But then we get a bit older ourselves and we find that we're doing the same thing, right? And you realize it's not because they're being hypocritical or something, but it's because the world's more complicated. And because those very simplistic rules, which were good enough for us as kids, are no longer adequate when we're adults, right? So this is one of the things that we have to learn, and one of the things which is very good in Buddhism, that we don't have to always find that there's a black and that choice is either right or wrong. Okay, I can't remember now whether this is something that we're going to be talking about later, but anyway, in Buddhism there's in some places a fourfold analysis of karma, right? So you have black karma, which is bad things, they have a bad result. White karma, which is good things, has a good result. You have both black and white karma, which has both black and white result. Right? So something which is both good and bad at the same time. Yeah? And you also have something which is neither black nor white karma, with neither black nor white result. Okay? This is an Indian fourfold logic, as we call the tetralemma. In Western philosophy, you always have a dilemma, right? It's always one thing or the other, and you have to try to shoehorn things into it. And one of the things that in Western philosophy, they tie themselves in knots about this, right? In ethical philosophy, you're always trying to figure out, is this right or is this wrong? And because according to Aristotelian logic, you only have these two alternatives. It's either is or it isn't. There's Indian logic, it's yes, and this is why you have it like this in India, right? It's sometimes yes, it's sometimes no, right? Yeah. And it's actually a much more realistic way of looking at the world, because obviously there are things that aren't either one or the other, right? Sometimes you can say yes, sometimes you say no, and sometimes you, okay. Right. In the suttas, like it has when the Buddha, somebody would invite the Buddha to dana or something like that, and it always says that the Buddha consented with silence. And some people argue that because he was Indian, that's what actually he was doing when he consented in silence. He was like that. Anyway, so this number three, and then the neither black nor white karma leading to neither black nor white results, of course, is the karma of practicing the Eightfold Path and leading to the ending of rebirth, okay? But the karma which is both black and white, yeah? And so very often those things that when we're faced with ethical dilemmas, right, we there actually isn't a right and a wrong answer, yeah? And sometimes you just have to say, well, this aspect of what you're doing is right and this aspect is wrong. And that right aspect will lead to a good result, the bad aspect will lead to a bad result. And you can't actually say, is it right or wrong? You say, well, overall, it's mixed. Yeah? And at the end of the day, people have to make a choice. So people often come to me as a monk
with these kinds of questions, you know. So, for example, they might ask a question, oh, I've got termites in my house, you know, what do I do? Do I spray the termites, right? If I don't do that, I don't have a house. I mean, I've got kids, I've got to have a house to live in, right? I can't let the termites just destroy my house. What am I supposed to do? Well, at the end of the day, to want to provide a home for your family and to look after them and so on is good karma, right? So that's a good thing that you're doing. But to kill termites is bad karma, right? So it's you can't reduce it. You can't say, is it right or wrong? You just have to say it's mixed. And you have to say, well, if you do make that choice, do it with that understanding, right? You just understand that it's a mixed choice and you try to maximize the good from it and minimize the bad. That's all you can do. And so sometimes, you know, you can't say to somebody, you should do this. Yeah? You just have to say, that's, you know, you have to make the choice. That's life. We even though it's mixed, we still have to live and we still have to make choices. Okay, so sorry? Just agreeing. Okay, thank you. So we have, like, when we take precepts and so on, right? Remember that the precepts are giving us a very simplistic overview of things, right? So you can't reduce all ethics to the precepts. I mean, how do the precepts work? Well, if you look in Buddhist cultures, right? The precepts are very much a kind of lowest common denominator, right? I mean, you think in Theravadan countries until recently, they were mostly sort of agrarian, rural countries, and you've got, you know, a lot of people living in villages, and they're farmers and things like that, and they're not going to be sitting around doing kind of detailed analysis of ethical problems and studying of suttas and all of these kinds of things. You can't do that. So what you can do is you can say, well, look, here's a list of five basic rules, and try to keep them as best as you can, right? And so it's very much this kind of, that's the lowest common denominator. So don't take the precepts as being something which is very black and white, but you take that as an overall guide. But the much more important thing is to be able to reflect and look at your own motivation and so on. So that's a little statue. What's that? Oh, that's Angulimala, I believe. I've got no idea why I put that in. I put that in last year, so I've forgotten. But there's something about Angulimala there. Oh, I think, is it Angulimala and his mum? I don't know. Oh, anyway, whatever. It's just a silly picture. Oh, there's Calvin and Hobbes. That's even better. Okay, Calvin and Hobbes. You can read that. Can you read it? Yeah? Yes? No? Yeah? So, ethical teachings from Calvin and Hobbes. Okay. So, one of the important things that we find in Buddhism is that we have a rational and a reasonable basis for ethical, for our ethics. And this is something which is actually, again, from I know from studying ethics in university, something which is very, very problematic in Western philosophy. Basically, Western philosophy has always traditionally based ethics on God, right? So if something's right or wrong because God said so. But then, oh, well, like, we don't believe in God anymore, so what does that mean? Yeah? And then that's this kind of crisis. And it was first talked about a lot by Nietzsche in the 19th century. And this is a crisis of values, and I don't think it's something which has been sort of really satisfactorily resolved in the West. And Western ethical philosophers are still struggling to find what is a basis for ethics. But within Buddhist sphere, Buddhist ethics is a form of what's known in the West as utilitarian ethics. And just to sort of give you a basic
understanding of what we mean by utilitarian ethics. One form of ethical theory says that it's like a theory of kind of natural law, is that that ethics in some way, ethical principles are somehow part of the fabric of the universe, like say the law of gravity or something like that, and you can kind of discover them. The problem with that theory is that, well, those laws are not really knowable, right? Everyone seems to have very different ideas of what those laws are. And it's a kind of metaphysical theory anyway. I mean, where are these laws, you know? To me, it's a kind of an echo of God-think. So in the 19th century, especially in England, this new school of ethics came up called the Utilitarian School, who basically said that what's ethical is the choice that brings the greatest good for the greatest number. Okay? Now, utilitarian ethics has a number of problems. Some of the problems are things we've already discussed, like how do we define happiness, right? So we can say it's for the greatest happiness of the greatest number, but actually how do you evaluate that, right? Also the question of, well, sometimes it seems that conflicts with our ethical intuitions because we think something should be the right thing to do, but it doesn't actually lead to the greatest happiness of the greatest number, yeah? So that's also a problem. So there are a number of different problems with utilitarianism. But I think that the form of utilitarianism that we find in Buddhism actually solves all of those problems. And so Buddhist utilitarian philosophy is not exactly the same as the Western one, but it's very similar. It's the same basic idea that we're associating our ethics with happiness, with the psychology, right? So if the intention is good, happiness results. If happiness results, the intention was good. Okay? These two things, they work together. Yeah? Yeah? So it's not like a one-way thing. It's an interrelation. Yeah? So sometimes we can know what our happiness is and we can know what our good intentions are. Right? So we can know these things through our introspection. Right? And we can investigate what is the relationship between them. Yeah? So when you do an act, you can understand what is your psychological state before you did it, during doing it, and after doing it. And you can reflect on that. And you can look at the relationship between what you did, the choices that you make, good choices, bad choices, and how did that affect your mind. Yeah? So this is actually, it's actually an empirical basis for ethics. Yeah? It's not based on some abstract theory or notion of rights or something like that, or rights or natural law or something. It's based on your actual experience of happiness and sadness and your own inner awareness of your intentions and how these things relate. Now, these things don't relate to each other in a simple way, right? So as we've mentioned before, there are often exceptions. Sometimes you do what you think is the right thing, but you don't feel happy afterwards. So there are complex relations. But at least this gives us a starting point, okay, that we can look at. It makes sense. And then we can reflect that, and we see that in most cases, actually it works out pretty straightforwardly, right? Most cases, when we do what's good, we feel good about it. Right? In most cases, we do what's bad, we feel bad about it. And the exceptions, okay, we can sort of look at them. So this to me is, again, one of the great things about Buddhist ethics is it gives us a grounding for ethics to understand it without having to invoke any kind of metaphysical principle or abstract philosophy. Okay? Any questions on that before we move on? Yeah. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
One thing you can try is to, like, just visualize. So imagine you did that.
Yes, you can use your imagination, exactly, yeah, and sort of follow through. See, how would you feel about that, yeah, if you did that? How would other people respond? Yeah, yep, that's very good. Okay, so I'm just wondering how long to go, because we're 8:45 already, so we might actually have a break. Do you think it's time to have a break? I think so, yeah, let's have a break till 9:00, and then we'll come back for the discussion group then. So make a cup of tea and so on. Okay, so now is our time to break off into discussion groups, and we can get the chance to discuss some of the topics that we've looked at today. So today has been an introduction to Buddhist ethics, and we've looked at the framework, the grounding, the theory of Buddhist ethics. In tomorrow's class, we're going to look more in detail at some of the precepts of Buddhist ethics.
But for now, we're looking at the general principles. So some of the things that we've talked about so far, how do we relate ethical choices to happiness? Is it possible to judge the happiness of another? Remember that the Buddha always talked about the happiness of oneself, the happiness of the other, and the happiness of everyone, right? The happiness of both, yeah? So obviously you can know your own happiness to some degree, but even that's a bit hard to figure out sometime, right? But then how is it easy to figure out the happiness of others, right? Especially when you come along to a Buddhist center and everyone's always smiling all the time and they're being very nice. And I remember one time years ago I opened up a tricycle magazine. I was looking through and like every picture on every page was this beaming, smiling person. And after, you know, 20 or 30 pages, I'm like, you people are not that happy. I don't believe you. And then throughout that whole magazine, right, there was one picture of somebody who wasn't smiling, right? And that was a picture of a Zen monk who was just coming out of meditation. And he was like, he's had this incredible kind of deep look of peacefulness on his face, yeah? And you say, ah, yeah, that's a real picture of, that's like real happiness. He was the only one who wasn't smiling. So if we can't, if it's hard enough for us to know our own happiness, how do we know the happiness of another, right? And do we always feel happy if we do the right thing? Yeah? So is there a way of cheating the law of karma, perhaps, right? So you can figure out a way of getting around it by not doing the right thing but still being happy anyway. So anyway, these are some of the kinds of things that we can talk about. So let's break up into discussion groups as we have done before. Probably similar thing. I think if we have maybe six groups, maybe one group in the library, and then the other groups out here, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in here should be good. Okay, let's do it. And we'll meet back here about 9:45 for final discussion. I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, I'm good. Then we don't know what to discuss. So, did anyone find the answers to these questions? No. Oh, goodness. We should really do this as like multiple choice questions, shouldn't we? Then you know whether you got the right answer or not. Okay. So, but let's just generally get feedback from the groups. What about the first question? Relating ethical choices to happiness. Is this something that we can do? Is this too hard? Is this doable? How do we? What was it? Any responses on that one? Any findings? Somebody in our group said that when they cheat on the parking coupons, and that they when they do it, they feel really happy when they get away with it. So.
Bhante, for our group, we will try to define happiness. What is happiness?
Mm.
Okay, and we more or less agree to a conclusion that there are three levels of happiness. The first level of happiness is sensual pleasure. You know, you eat durian, you feel happy. You know, so that's nice. But that's all right. Okay. So it's very subjective, okay? It differs from one person to another person. It's happiness to me doesn't mean it's happiness to another person, you know? For example, durian, okay? Or char kway teow, whatever. Okay. The next level of happiness is success, you know? If I start lottery, I feel happy, okay? If my son scores a string of A's, I feel happy. But, yeah, that is also very fleeting. Okay. Yeah. The third level of happiness is this mind, the sati, the samadhi. Okay. It peaks with nibbana.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. That is related to ethical choice because you need to have certain ethics for the mind to be calm and peaceful to reach that level of samadhi, calm, peaceful,
yeah.
Bright, relaxed.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's good. Any other comments on that first topic? Or what about the second topic? Is it possible to judge the happiness of another? Is it? What do you reckon?
Bhante,
yes.
My group, there's a lady who wants to ask a question.
Please.
But she asked me to ask on her behalf.
That's very good. That's an old tradition, you know, when the Buddha... But it's Parinibbana, and he said, if you don't know, ask, you get your friend to ask for you. So that's what you're doing.
Okay, so the question is, the family, I mean the mother is quite sick and need to go for treatment. So the mother says that if it's within that certain budget, she will go for it. So apparently the treatment is much more than that. And the brothers, I mean the children have decided to tell a white lie saying that actually it's much lesser so that the mother will go for it.
Mm.
And luckily, mother was cured.
Okay.
But now the children are a bit having this worry because they have broken the precept.
Mm.
But they are happy because their mother is healthy.
Mm. Oh, that's
so
interesting.
Just
one
Bhante's view on this.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting dilemma. And I think, you know, that falls into the black and white thing, isn't it? You know, it's a black karma to tell a lie and to lie to your mum, especially. And speaking from experience here, and see, the thing is, mums know a lot more. Well, one of the things I did not learn when growing up is that mums know a lot more than they let on, right? So, you know, when I was at school and then I'd say to mum, oh, I'm not feeling very well, I don't know, I think I'm going to go to school, oh, I've got a tummy ache, and, you know, and mum knows that you just want to have a day home from school, and, you know, she's, oh, okay, you just stay home. So sometimes they kind of know more than they let on, so perhaps the mother might not have been so ignorant of the cost of the medical procedure as you might imagine that she was. But look, in that kind of case, I think the best thing to do is to say, well, look, it is a mix of black and white, but I think in that case, obviously, the white has greatly outbalanced the black, so I wouldn't worry about it too much. But then your question is, well, how do we minimize that black karma? And the way to minimize the black karma is to go and tell your mum that you're lying. Yeah, and ask for her forgiveness. She might. That's a risk you have to take. Yeah. Yeah. And, but she also might die before you ever tell her. Yeah. So at least you can tell her that while she's alive. If she died, then, yeah, you wouldn't be able to do that. So that's what I would recommend, is just go to her and say, look, Mum, just let you know that this cost a lot more than we said it did. But, yeah.
But the children are saying that if the mum were to knew about this, she'll be very, very angry.
Well, she'll get over it. Yeah. Well, this is a very important point, actually, in this kind of thing and this honesty. When we make these kinds of decisions, okay, right? Think of how the logic of that goes. We know what the right thing to do is. We know that we said that lie. We know what the reasons were. The right thing to do is to go and tell her. That's very simple, right? But she might get angry. Therefore, we can't. Okay, it's not your right to decide whether she can be angry or not. Okay? It's her response. And if she wants to get angry with you, that's her right to do so. Okay? So you've done one thing, which is to lie to her in the first place, and now you're also taking away from her the ability to actually choose how she wants to respond. Okay? You're now doing a second thing. This came up with me a little while ago. Somebody came and it was very kind of sad. I mean, this guy was devastated, and he said that he just had an affair, you know, slept with another woman. He said, I've been married for 15 years. I've never even thought about it. You know, I went to this party, I got drunk and slept with this woman, and now that was like a week ago. And he said he just feels so terrible, and he can't tell his wife, and he just doesn't know what to do. And he feels so guilty. He's like been incredibly nice to his wife for the last week, and done all of these kinds of things, you know, and his wife saying, wow, if only you could be like this forever. Yeah. And you know, you could see the poor guy was just, you know, he was just heartbroken and devastated and stuff. And he's saying, but if I tell her, maybe she'll leave me, maybe she'll be so distressed, you know. And I said to him, that's her choice, right? If she wants to leave you, that's her choice. Don't take that choice away from him. You're the one who's made the mistake, right? Right? You have no right, right, to stop her from living her own life and making her own choices. Okay? You tell her the best way that you can, right, and give her the respect, right, that she can actually make her choice. And if that means that she leaves you, you have to respect that choice, because you're the one who's stuffed up, not her. So you've done one thing wrong already. Don't do a second thing wrong. Yeah? Okay. Which brings to the next one. Do we always feel happy if we do the right thing? Yeah, obviously, we have these cases where people are not always so clear about it. Sometimes things have unintended consequences, don't they, right? So you have all the good motivations, you do something, but then it doesn't quite turn out. Anyway, any more questions? We have time for one more question before we finish. No? Yep. Yes. I can hear, yeah.
Talk about motivation to generate happiness and give the example of the generosity. So during the break, I was trying to discuss with some of the members to say that motivation, the example you gave about generosity, is dependent on others being worse off than you to create that motivation. So are there any motivation that is not dependent? Meaning that if you have to, other people have to be worse off than you in order for you to be generous.
Yeah.
If other people are well off than you, then you have no such opportunity to be generous. So are there any
I don't know if that's always true. I mean, you can still be generous to people.
I know, there are various means, I know, but if there's a means that is dependent on something,
okay,
then it is not as good as something, some motivation which is not dependent on others being worse off than you. Example, if you are the lowest class of society, which is the poorest, and everybody is well off, then everybody got a bowl of rice and you got nothing to eat. You can't offer anything to anybody. You cannot be generous. So how can you be happiness by being generous?
When I was traveling around India some time ago, on a pilgrimage at one time, we were waiting on one of the train stations, and someone had given me a can of Coke. And at that time, there was a few of these kind of street kids hanging around. And, you know, there's this one little girl I remember very, very well, and I had this can of Coke and I wasn't going to drink it and stuff, so I just gave it to her. And she sort of hung around a little bit and so on. And then she sort of came up to me, she's looking shy and so on, and then she gave it back to me. Right? So she had nothing, right? She was wearing a couple of tattered rags, probably sleeping on the streets and stuff like that. And I've got no idea why she gave me back the can of Coke, but that was all that she had. And so she wanted to give it. So she gave it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they only had one pair of cloth for themselves. Usually that's what you find. The poorer people are, the more generous they are. But But the more general question that you're asking is, you know, if you can have acts that aren't dependent on anything. No, you can't. Every act is dependent. Every act has a context. It's relative to something. Yeah, there's no such thing as a purely good act that doesn't have a context. Yeah, so there'll always be some kind of environment. Yeah, it's always dependent on something. So we don't, you know, try to avoid that. We just try to understand it and work with it skillfully. You know, another example that comes to me from India, like when we were traveling around, is that everybody said, you know, don't feed the beggars on the street. You know, I mean, we were told this so many times, you know, they're part of organized mobs and there's people running them and it's just a racket and they'll take off all the money and they actually keep these people in poverty and so on. And it's very bad, actually. But, you know, still you found that some people would just give things to all the street beggars. And so, but, you know, you use your wisdom and you say, well, actually you give to the institutions and the charities who are working to help people. And that's much more effective. So sometimes, you know, you need to have that bit of ability to be reflective about things rather than just responding too much, too quickly. Okay, so we should probably wrap up there. It's after 10 o'clock. Let's, we will look forward to seeing you all tomorrow evening.